Chapter 10, The Solidarity Dividend. I parked in a vacant lot on the southernmost end of Lisbon Street, the main thoroughfare of Lewiston, Maine. The street dead ends near the old canal, built to power the cotton mills that made Lewiston one of the more prosperous towns in America in the late 1800s. The mills, the prosperity, even much of the canal, are now gone. Dying mill towns, like Lewiston, have been ground zero for propagation of the zero-sum story. Lewiston was once great for its white residents and began to fall apart in the same era when civil rights were on the rise and the country grew more diverse. Progress for people of color means a loss for white people. But this equation adds up only if you leave out the decisions by corporate employers to seek cheaper labor, or the trade policies that were the final death knell in the 1990s and 2000s. Maine is the state with the whitest and oldest population in the country, whose children are the least likely in the country to have a classmate of color. The state ranks among the top 10 in opioid deaths. From 2011 to 2019, the state's governor, Paul LePage, campaigned and governed on rhetoric about illegal immigrants on welfare and drug-dealing people of color. These are guys by the name D-Money, Smoothie, Shifty. These type of guys that come from Connecticut, New York. They come up here, they sell their heroin, then they go back home. Incidentally, half the time they impregnate a young white girl before they leave, which is the real sad thing because then we have another issue we got to deal with down the road. Meanwhile, he vetoed Medicaid expansion for the working class 5 times and delivered large tax cuts for the wealthy. I traveled to the state's second biggest city, Lewiston, because of the ways its residents are especially vulnerable to the zero-sum story, but also because of a promising phenomenon I saw signs of about 10 minutes into my walk up the town's main street. At the beginning of my walk, many of the buildings I saw, richly constructed 19th-century brick with Italianate moldings, stood stately and vacant, with neatly boarded-up windows on the ground floor. Here and there, a storefront lawyer's office appeared with a couple of desks needing far less space than it had. A pawn shop complex occupied much of an entire block. But once I crossed Chestnut Street, Lisbon Street came alive. Windows were suddenly stacked high with goods, framed by posters for mobile wire transfers and prepaid cards. One store had an arresting display of kaftans and hijabs in bright, coordinated colors. Another, next to the shadow of a faded old grocery store sign, had a sign reading Mogadishu Business Center. The shop offered groceries, a restaurant, money transfer, a seamstress, a tax preparer, cleaning services, halal meat, and sweet, strong coffee, as I learned when I stopped in to fuel up. The door chimes marked my departure from the street into a warm, fragrant, and music-filled shop. In the aisle near a wall of bulk spices, I saw 2 men and a young boy speaking in a language I recognized as Somali. As I ordered my coffee from the young hijab-wearing woman behind the counter, we chatted about how long she'd been in Maine, 7 years, the weather, what good comes from complaining? And, after my first sip, the spices in my coffee. A secret blend, but yes, cardamom. I exited the Somali shop and looked around at the white and black residents on the street with a smile. Maybe these somewhat accidental neighbors were destined to create another story, a different formula from the zero sum, one more fitting for our future as a nation of many. I turned off Lisbon to enter the historic city hall. Through the open doors, I saw a stately marble hallway flanked by large portraits of every mayor in Lewiston history. I understood the reason for the tribute, but I also recognized, from so many institutions I'd been in, how it feels to be a person who doesn't look like the images on the walls, which were almost all of white men. It's hard not to get the message that this place, no matter who occupies it at the moment, belongs to them, not you. Then, Down the middle of that long hallway came bounding a man as animated as the portraits were still. Phil Nadeau, the deputy city administrator. He greeted me warmly and showed me into an office decked with maps and memorabilia. My eye immediately went to the famous photograph of Muhammad Ali in the boxing ring, lording over the knockdown Sonny Liston. I was shocked when Nadeau told me that the heavyweight title fight had happened just around the corner in Lewiston in a youth hockey rink in 1965. Unlike the elected and largely symbolic mayors, Nadeau was an urban planner appointed to run the day-to-day nuts and bolts of the town. He explained Lewiston's decline in blunt terms. It was a one-and-a-half industry town. Come the 60s and 70s, when it's pretty clear the jobs are going, there's little that you can do to stop it. There were a variety of things that we tried to help those businesses remain viable, but it was a losing battle against a global economy. Soon, everything that was once manufactured in Lewiston would be made in the American South with cheaper labor, and eventually in China and Southeast Asia. By the 2000s, the loss of jobs had created a vicious circle. As young people left to find work, there was nobody to work the few service sector jobs that remained in the wake of shuttered factories. Then, with the town losing population year after year, it was impossible to attract new employers. Lisbon Street, once the second biggest commercial district in the state, began to show as many vacant windows as store displays. When Nadeau moved to his position in Lewiston city government in the early 2000s, it became clear to him that only one thing would save the town: new people. Maine is the oldest state in the country, one of only two now in the country, Maine and West Virginia, where deaths now exceed births. None of this is good news. I asked him why getting new people actually mattered to those who stayed. How did he counter the idea that newcomers were just competing for dwindling resources? He shook his head emphatically. You can't convince businesses to either expand or move into your state or into your community if the bodies aren't there. These companies know this about Maine, but here's the city of Lewiston bucking that trend. The secret to Lewiston's success was something of an accident. In the early 1990s, the U.S. government accepted thousands of refugees from the Somali Civil War and resettled many to the Atlanta suburbs of Georgia. Word of mouth got some to Portland and then to Lewiston, where the quiet streets offered more peace and the low rents more security. Family by family, Lewiston's refugee population grew. Soon, it wasn't just Somalis, but many other African refugees from the Congo, Chad, Djibouti, and Sudan. The refugee arrivals are filling apartments that were vacant for a long time. They're filling storefronts on Lisbon Street that were vacant for a long time. They're contributing to the economy. Phil Nadeau is passionate about the value of the new Mainers, as he calls them, to the revitalization of Lewiston. He boasts that while other Maine small towns had plummeting real estate values, fleeing young people, and shuttering schools, Lewiston is building new schools and creating the jobs that come with that. Though Phil also credits good regional planning and maintenance of the historic assets, the infrastructure built nearly a century ago, the hundreds of thousands of square feet of factories that have not become blighted, he simply can't say enough about the benefit of migration to small towns like his. A bipartisan think tank calculated that Maine's African immigrant households contributed $194 million in state and local taxes in 2018. When I met Nadeau, he was in his last weeks on a job that has taken him through multiple administrations of elected mayors who, to put it mildly, haven't shared his enthusiasm for the changing face of Lewiston. But Phil has seen the economic fortunes of the town reverse, and for a city planner, there's nothing controversial about that. He plans to spend his retirement crossing the country to share the good word about how immigration can be a win-win for locals. I could talk about it all day long. Phil sat back in his chair and allowed a broad smile to finish his point. Before I left, I asked Phil if I could take some pictures of his office for my recollection. I took a shot of his Ali portrait. Some in the town have adopted the story of Ali's knockdown punch as a symbol of Lewiston. where people knew how it felt to get knocked down. The old-timers who'd seen their fortunes fade when the jobs disappeared. But also, of course, the refugees who had lost everything before coming to America's shores. The Ali-Liston fight was historic for another reason that would be special to the new Mainers. It was the first time that Cassius Clay was introduced by his new Muslim name. Lewiston is not alone in this new wave of new people. For the past 20 years, Latinx, African, and Asian immigrants have been repopulating small towns across America. Pick a state, and you'll find this story in one corner or another. Kennett Square, Pennsylvania, is now 50% Latinx, mostly from Mexico, and it's a community given new life by the families of migrant workers at the local mushroom farms. In Storm Lake, Iowa, the elementary school is 90% children of color. Towns across the Texas panhandle have been drying up and losing population for years, but the potato farming stronghold of Dallard grew by 7% from 1990 to 2016 because of Latinx families. Low-paid farm and food processing work is what draws foreign-born people to these small towns at first, for sure. But once there, immigrants have, as European immigrants did a century ago, started businesses, gained education, and participated in civic life. Though the Europeans' transition to whiteness offered a glide path to the middle class, unavailable to immigrants of color today. Even in the face of anti-immigrant policies and the absence of vehicles for mobility, such as unions and housing subsidies, today's immigrants of color are revitalizing rural America. A study of more than 2,600 rural communities found that over the three decades after 1990, two-thirds lost population. However, immigration helped soften the blow in the majority of these places, and among the areas that gained population, one in five owes the entirety of its growth to immigration. In the decade after 2000, people of color made up nearly 83% of the growth in rural population in America. And many of these communities, longtime residents, who are overwhelmingly white, have chosen not to feel threatened by these new people of color. The temptation is there, and the encouragement from anti-immigrant politicians is certainly there. But the growth and prosperity the new people bring give the lie to the zero-sum model. Locals know that the alternative to new people is compounding losses. Factories, residents, then the hospitals and the schools and the attendant jobs. So the residents are putting aside prejudices in order to grow their hometowns together. If they don't, wrote Art Cullen, the local newspaper editor in Storm Lake, Iowa, there will be nobody left to turn out the lights by 2050 in towns like his. Asians and Africans and Latinos are our lifeline, he declared flatly in 2018. These small town success stories are full of local gestures, both big and small, to integrate the newcomers, ranging from free ESL classes to community college partnerships to help new immigrants get degrees. One of these gestures changed the life of Lewiston resident Cecile Thornton, but it wasn't she who offered the education to her new neighbors. They gave it to her. A quarter of Maine's citizens, like Cecile, have Franco-American heritage, mostly descendants of French-speaking Canadian immigrants who came to work the cotton mills and shoe factories 100 years ago. But only 3% of the state speaks French regularly at home. And Cecile is among the many Francos who have lost their French. Cecile was born in 1955 to French-speaking parents and did her best to forget the French she'd learned at the dinner table, escaping to the living room once the family got a TV set and repeating the words of Walter Cronkite to learn how real Americans spoke. The Francos were the butt of schoolyard jokes, so by high school, Cecile made sure to suppress her accent altogether and held on to very few words of her native French. When I met her, she'd also lost the closeness of her family. All of my family's away, including my kids, she told me. They're all out of state, and my aunts and uncles, my parents, all those people are dead. The kind of isolation that Cecile faced when she retired to an empty home in Lewiston has become a growing epidemic among older people in rural and suburban America. The former U.S. Surgeon General has linked it to the diseases of despair that are disproportionately haunting white Americans facing economic decline, alcoholism, drug abuse, and suicide. Social isolation has been found to lower life expectancy by a degree comparable to smoking almost a pack of cigarettes a day. But a few years ago, Cecile made a decision that turned her story around. She got in her car to drive to the Franco Center downtown. She went looking for a connection to other people, to her community, to the language that had filled her home as a child. What she found on the first day at the center, however, was a room full of elderly people who had long ago traded away French for belonging, to become no longer Francos, but simply white. It was a cultural assimilation that happened in time to every group of white-skinned immigrants in the 19th and early 20th centuries, from the Italians to the Poles. What America offered for the price of assimilation was inclusion in the pool of whites-only benefits that shaped the middle class, but we don't talk much about what they left behind. The Franco Center had a rule: put a quarter in a jar every time you spoke English. The maximum penalty was $1, though, so when Cecile looked around, all the tables had jars full of dollars and conversations carrying on in English. She couldn't hide her disappointment. Even here at the Franco Center, her community's language seemed lost. In her isolation, the idea of reclaiming her French had become a lifeline, though, so she wasn't giving up. She found the most talkative person in the room and complained. He told her, "You should go to the French Club at Hillview." Hillview is a subsidized housing project in Lewiston. When Cecile arrived at 1 o'clock on a weekday afternoon for the advertised French Club, she was shocked to see that she was the only white person there. "I didn't even know at the time that we had Africans in the city who spoke French. I had no clue, none." The first man she spoke with, Edo, had just followed his wife and children to Lewiston from Congo. After a timid bonjour from Cecile, she and Edo had launched into the longest French conversation Cecile had had since her childhood, with Edo helping her recall long-gone words and phrases. By the end of the first session, she was exhausted but thrilled. "Just as an interested and curious person, when I was meeting these people, I just fell in love with them." She laughs, knowing what that sounds like. "Not that I really fell in love with them, but I felt like I belonged with them." Over the next year, Cecile would make the Francophone African community of Lewiston the center of her life. When she noticed that it became hard for Hillview folks to attend French Club once they enrolled in community college downtown or got a job, she launched a new French Club at the more convenient Franco Center downtown, but she heavily recruited her new African friends to come. With Cecile's encouragement, soon the two populations of French speakers were mixing. Elderly white Mainers with halting vocabularies learning from new black Mainers who spoke fluently. Francophone Africans like Edo, once seen as strange folks from far away, were now teachers. Today, Cecile volunteers to help asylum seekers, doing winter coat drives and connecting new arrivals to services, but she'd be the first to say that what she gives pales in comparison with what she has received. Bruce Nodden would say the same. A few years ago, Bruce was the father of two kids and the owner of a thriving sports equipment business. But he also had a drug and alcohol addiction that nearly killed him. He was on the verge of becoming a statistic, a white, middle-aged man succumbing to the opioid epidemic stalking Maine and other white enclaves across America. But after he hit rock bottom, a chance encounter led him to becoming a community organizer. "My wife says my new addiction is being in the community," he told me with a chuckle. In 2015, Bruce was participating in a jail ministry as part of his recovery. In the jail parking lot, he noticed a woman unloading from her car the best-smelling food. She was bringing it to the handful of Muslim men in the jail who would break their fast after sundown. He'd of course noticed the rising numbers of African refugees in Lewiston over the years, and generally found them a source of curiosity, but he'd never ventured a conversation. In the parking lot, he and the woman got to talking about what each of them was doing at the jail. She introduced herself as Zamzam, and then Bruce heard words coming out of his mouth that surprised even him. "God is God." They traded phone numbers on the spot. After that, things happened quickly. Zamzam encouraged him to join the Maine People's Alliance, a 32,000-member-strong grassroots group advocating for policies like Medicaid expansion, a minimum wage increase, paid sick leave, and support for home care. His activism would take him into deeper engagement with the Muslim immigrant community in Lewiston. Somalis taught him how to handle a rude voter while canvassing on a mayoral campaign. As he shared his frustrations about corruption in the Catholic Church, men from Djibouti opened up about the hypocrisy of their religious leaders. Bruce has become a lead organizer of an annual cross-cultural festival, the Community Unity Barbecue, which brings out hundreds of Lewiston residents. Last summer, as he spent hours standing over a hot stove in the park learning to make Somali flatbreads, he couldn't help thinking of his own Franco ancestors, who fled persecution and found refuge in Lewiston, and what they'd gone through to finally be accepted. "The vision for me for this city," Bruce told me, "is that we will embrace our past, embrace our ethnicity, and then embrace the people that are here now that are just like those people that came here 100-plus years ago. They're exactly like that. But actually, they're even worse off. They didn't always have a job. They were escaping atrocities in their country. They were escaping possibly dying or seeing their children die. And they needed to work. There should be this massive amount of empathy from that next 2, 3, 4 generations down from those people that went through the same stuff as these people are going through, and saying, we're going to embrace you. You're going to help us make this city great again." Moments like Bruce's cross-cultural festival provide glimpses of the way Lewiston and much of America could be, but they're few and far between. The zero-sum tension is still prominent, even in Lewiston with all its successes. Phil Nadeau's enthusiasm for the net economic gains of creating a more diverse Lewiston had me convinced that I'd found the antidote to the zero-sum narrative. But then I talked to Ben Chen, the Maine People's Alliance deputy director, who told me wryly, "Unless you're 3 relationships removed from Phil or closer, you haven't heard that and you don't believe it." After my conversation with Phil, I went back to Lisbon Street to the Mogadishu Business Center to talk with one of the owners, Saeed, a gregarious Somali man with soft brown eyes. Saeed told me that one of the first white Mainers to venture into the store was a woman named Brenda, who was drawn by the clothes hanging in the front. She asked so many questions that it became evident that she was a skilled seamstress who had been out of work for some time. She struck up a rapport with the store's other owner, Saeed's wife, known to all as Mama Shukri. Mama Shukri offered Brenda a job repairing the hijabs and kaftans people would bring into the shop. Saeed explains, "And then she started making new clothes after that." My eyes got wider. "So Brenda started making African clothes?" Saeed nodded matter-of-factly. "Yeah, she's very good." He told me more stories about integration going well at the person-to-person level, including the Lewiston Blue Devils soccer team, which African immigrant kids from 6 countries had led to 3 years of state championships. White Mainers and African Mainers doing business together was going well too, he said. It's the government he worries about. In fact, Lewiston has been governed by mayors using harsh anti-immigrant rhetoric for all of the 20 years that Somalis have been present. After the first group of families arrived in Lewiston by word of mouth, then-Mayor Laurier Raymond Jr. wrote an open letter saying that the town was full, even though much of downtown lay vacant. "This large number of new arrivals cannot continue without negative results for all," Raymond wrote. The letter became a rallying cry for white supremacists who descended on the town for a march soon after. An early Republican in the Trump mold, Governor Paul LePage, won his elections campaigning against welfare, suggesting that immigrants were stealing resources from the local taxpayers. Saeed shook his head. "So the mayor is going to a lectern and saying, Oh, because of the Somalis, we're going to cut the welfare. Because these people, they're coming here only for welfare. His eyes got a little distant, as they did when he was talking about home. In Central and Southern Africa, there's a saying, when election day comes, keep your knife close. That's when the problems happen, especially inter-clan problems. But once the election is gone, people are normal. Everyone is looking for his life. They're trading with each other, friends getting married together. But the one day election comes, the knives are out. The politicians will try to separate us. The politicians will try to separate us. The people I met, Phil, Bruce, Cecile, Saeed with his coworker Brenda, belong to a beachhead of solidarity amid a surge in xenophobia, pushed relentlessly by politicians in Lewiston and across the country. The faith that the Lewiston people I met had in the idea of different cultures not only coexisting but thriving through their differences didn't come from theory or ideology. It came from lived experience. Each of them had had a reason to roll up their sleeves and put in the time to make some part of their community work better. And in so doing, they had bettered themselves. But the resistance of many white Mainers to new people isn't about just dollars and cents, if we're honest. It's also about the fear of a loss of community, of identity, of home. It was striking to me that what old Mainers were worried about losing is something that, by definition, the new Mainers have actually lost. Home. And for people like Cecile and Bruce, cross-cultural friendships have given them a deeper sense of community than they ever had before. Yet in Lewiston, with its 35,000 residents, a 2015 mayoral campaign presaged the turn that national politics would take once Donald Trump launched his presidential campaign by calling Mexican immigrants rapists. Incumbent Republican Mayor Robert McDonald, who was enthusiastically supported by the immigrant-bashing governor, ran a fear-mongering zero-sum campaign against Democrat Ben Chin of the Maine People's Alliance. A multiracial millennial, Ben is a community organizer and Episcopalian lay minister who was explicitly trying to counter that division. Ben looks even younger than his years, with the lean build of a triathlete. His grandfather was a Chinese immigrant who fought for the United States in World War II, built a successful business, and then was targeted in the McCarthy era. Ben grew up in Pittsburgh and Syracuse, New York, also declining manufacturing cities. But when he arrived at college in Lewiston, he found the kind of issues that every big city has, but on a small enough scale where you can have some kind of impact and make a difference. When Ben and his volunteers were out knocking on doors, he heard firsthand the effect of the zero-sum narrative. Urban legends were repeated freely. The big one was Somali people get a free car as soon as they come to America, he told me. And that just stuck. Once LePage gets elected in 2010 and Mayor McDonald gets elected in 2011, and you just have these two guys using the bully pulpit, just driving this relentless message that is anti-immigrant for all these strategic reasons that mostly end up hurting white people, like cutting Medicaid. When I go out canvassing, sometimes you're in neighborhoods where every other door, you're hearing something like that. Ben's campaign for mayor focused on economic justice issues like increasing the minimum wage and access to affordable housing, and on integrating immigrants into the community. His campaign energized a cross-racial group of supporters and volunteers and relied on the community organizing techniques of person-to-person outreach. His goal, he said publicly, was to make sure Lewiston is a city where everyone has a shot at their dreams. When I ran the first time, he told me, one of the slumlords that we at the Maine People's Alliance were holding accountable put up a bunch of signs around town calling me Ho Chi Chin with a racist caricature of my face and a hammer and a sickle. His story called to mind Senator Claude Pepper, whose support for a policy that would have benefited mostly white people led rich people to target him with a red-baiting racist campaign as well. Ben countered these scorched-earth tactics with a base of young and passionate supporters, exceeding state fundraising records mostly with small donations and coming within 600 votes of unseating the incumbent mayor. In 2017, Ben ran again, made it to a runoff and then lost by just 145 votes after a leaked email thrust the issue of racism into the campaign weeks before the election. Ben had just finished a long day of door knocking when he emailed notes to his campaign staff about his 47 conversations with voters that day. A woman who wanted to volunteer for him after losing her sister to an overdose. Good talks with two African-American families. Swaying a former McDonald's supporter who was leaning his way. And a bunch of racists, too, he'd written. Somebody leaked the notes to the press, and Ben's frank appraisal caused a firestorm. The right-wing media seized on it and made it seem like he'd accused the entire town. Leaked email. Ben Chen says Lewiston voters, bunch of racists. I asked Ben about it. It turns out, this particular street that I was referencing in this email was one of the wealthiest streets in town, so it hit a nerve, right? Because I actually think the racism in Lewiston, the center of gravity, is not in the working class parts. It's in these sort of swankier, more upscale parts of town. Through all the campaigning ups and downs, Ben held on to his conviction that white working class voters would one day see through the racist narratives that his opponents were using to sell them an agenda that betrayed them. As someone who shared his conviction, I hoped he was right. His opponents' agenda had already included three major tax cuts for the wealthy that squeezed public services and led to higher property taxes on the working and middle class. Ben's first opponent, Mayor McDonald, proposed that all welfare recipients be publicly named on a website and that asylum seekers be banned from the state assistance program, even though the law also banned them from working for months while waiting for their legal status. And Governor LePage refused to expand Medicaid after passage of the Affordable Care Act, vetoing it five times during a period when almost 10% of the state's population was uninsured. These men invoked the age-old story of competition that is deployed to make people feel less generous and welcoming and more supportive of austerity measures. But in Maine, white people constitute about 95% of the population, and 11.5% of them were in poverty in 2016. Twice as many white people in poverty as there were people of color of all incomes in the whole state. The people who needed government services were overwhelmingly white. Finally, starting in the fall of 2017, Ben and the 32,000 members of the Maine People's Alliance were able to win a string of victories that began to refill the pool of public services in Maine and justify Ben's faith. Maine became the first state in the nation to vote to expand Medicaid by ballot initiative over the governor's repeated refusal. The ballot campaign faced racist tactics but overcame them. During the campaign, there was certainly an attempt to racialize it, and the code word for that was welfare. And our canvassers would knock on doors, and sometimes, unfortunately, even the people who would be eligible for Medicaid said they were against it because they thought it could be going to immigrants and other people they thought would be undeserving. But we won it resoundingly. I asked Ben how they were able to overcome the race baiting, and he explained that the multiracial coalition was the key. And by coalition, I really do mean this broader working-class set of folks that cross lines of race and all of that. We were hoping for a lot more support from bigwigs like folks in the hospital association, but it was this broader base of working-class people that actually got it across the finish line, not the muckety-mucks. The winning political coalition included, for the first time, immigrant-led political action committees, and the Get Out the Vote effort was anchored by a network of Somali taxi drivers, who use their infrastructure of radios and vehicles to get elderly, homebound, immigrant, and poor Mainers to the polls safely. Since then, Maine has experienced a solidarity dividend. Rejecting the scapegoating politics that enabled a right-wing government to deny health care and creating new political alliances between workers of all backgrounds resulted in 60,000 Mainers winning access to health care. These same organizers and volunteers helped elect a wave of new politicians the following year, who passed reforms to address the opioid epidemic and guarantee a generous paid time off law for Maine workers. The next frontier of cross-racial coalition building, though, is for white people not just to stop voting against their own interests, but to vote for the interests of people of color, too, on issues of racial justice. In the whitest state in the union, there are promising signs that this is happening. A slate of progressive school board candidates in Maine are running explicitly on racial equity. The slate includes a white suburban mom in Bangor, a Somali social worker, a South Sudanese graduate of Maine Public Schools, a 25-year-old queer grocery clerk with Asperger's syndrome, and a white transgender man with 24 years' experience as a school teacher who wears a T-shirt in his campaign video that reads, "I'm not black, but I will fight for you." The candidates have championed racial justice issues such as removing police in schools, equitably funding the increasingly diverse South Portland district, and creating anti-racist curricula. And back in Lewiston, the mayor who beat Ben Chin, Shane Bouchard, ended up resigning his seat over a racist text message. It turns out that the person who had leaked Ben's email had been having an affair with Bouchard. She eventually had a crisis of conscience and revealed the whole story, including Bouchard's texts with racist and sexist jokes. "All my jokes are quite racist, LOL," he wrote her. "What do you call two old black people sitting on your front lawn?" he had texted her. "Antique farm equipment." When I heard that, I was honestly shocked, and I don't shock easily. At first blush, it would seem implausible that a white millennial from Maine, not Mississippi, would even have a frame of reference for making a casual, dehumanizing joke about slavery. But then I chided myself for buying the myth of Northern innocence and forgetting how interconnected it all is. Maine once had the largest Ku Klux Klan membership outside of the South, and the textile mills that made the city of Lewiston were, of course, processing Southern cotton. 5 discoveries. My journey across the U.S. from California to Mississippi to Maine, tallying the costs of racism, has led me to 5 discoveries about how we can prosper together. The first is that we have reached the productive and moral limit of the zero-sum economic model that was crafted in the cradle of the United States. We have no choice but to start aiming for a solidarity dividend. The second is that the quickest way to get there is to refill the pool of public goods for everyone. When our nation had generous public benefits, they were the springboard for a thriving middle class, but they were narrowly designed to serve white and soon-to-be-white Americans. Third, because of that, our people are not all standing at the same depths today. So we must resist the temptation to use universal instruments to attain universal ends. When it comes to designing solutions, one size has never fit all. Everywhere that I found white people paying the spillover costs of racism, I also found that, without exception, their coworkers and neighbors of color were paying even more, in lost wealth, health, and often lives. Getting white support to address those different levels of need and to acknowledge the racism that caused those differences is never easy, particularly when the zero-sum mental model turns every concession into a threat of loss. That's why uprooting the zero-sum is so essential, as is embedding in its place the value that I found radiating out of the people who had the biggest impact on me and their communities, the knowledge that we truly do need each other. The fifth and final discovery is that we've got to get on the same page before we can turn it. We've tried a do-it-yourself approach to writing the racial narrative about America, but the forces selling denial, ignorance, and projection have succeeded in robbing us of our own shared history, both the pain and the resilience. It's time to tell the truth, with a nationwide process that enrolls all of us in setting the facts straight so that we can move forward with a new story, together. What we've got now just isn't working. When the rules of the game allow a small minority of participants to capture most of the gains, at a certain point, for example, when the entire middle class owns less than the wealthiest 1% of Americans, fewer people can play at all. Extreme inequality robs too many people of the means to start businesses, invest in their families, and invent new ideas and solutions. And then it isn't a problem just for those families. ultimately having millions of people with potential on the sidelines because they have too much debt and not enough opportunity, saps the vitality of the entire economy. There's a growing body of literature that shows that inequality itself impedes a country's economic growth, even more than the factors policymakers have emphasized in the past: liberalizing trade policies, controlling inflation, and reducing national debt. And America's racial inequality is not only the most extreme manifestation of our inequality, but also the template, setting up a scaffolding of hierarchy that increasingly few people of any race can climb. The plutocrats have always known that solidarity is the answer, that the sum of us can accomplish far more than just some of us. That's why the forces seeking to keep the economic rules exactly as they are aim to cut off any sense of empathy white people who are struggling might develop for also struggling people of color. Their punching down political attacks are how we know that empathy is a strength. Bridget from Kansas City Fight for 15 discovered the power of solidarity in a basement organizing meeting when she saw her own life reflected in that of a Latina fast food worker. Until then, not only had Bridget bought into a dehumanizing narrative about people like the woman who spoke that night and Black people like Terrence, she'd also bought the idea that her own labor would never be worth $15 an hour. There's something about the mentality of degrading others in your same position that can make you unable to see a better life for yourself either. When you believe the dominant story that you're on your own, responsible for all your own successes and failures, and yet you're still being paid $7.25 an hour, what does that say about your own worth? The problem with the easy out that the right wing offers, scapegoating immigrants and people of color instead, is that the scapegoats aren't actually the ones paying you poverty wages. As my friend George Gale, head of People's Action, a grassroots network that organizes in rural America, says, "We've found the enemy, and it's not each other." Bridget and Terrence found that redirecting the blame toward the people actually setting the rules was liberating. Finding a sea of potential allies in the people who worked alongside them was empowering. That's the solidarity dividend.